Once back at the commandery, Kate left Olsen in charge of the prisoner's relocation. He needed some time alone to try and marshal his thoughts. Things were happening quickly, and he hadn't had nearly enough time to consider the implications. After informing the captain of the guard where he would be, he set off on a long walk around the commandery grounds. He puzzled over the information his team had uncovered so far. There were gaping holes in it, but he thought he was beginning to see a form to it, a sense of pattern appearing out of the chaos. He had yet to determine how the enemy was learning the locations of the commanderies, however, and that set him to thinking about the idea that there was a mole in the order. Despite the preceptor's suspicions, he had yet to see anything that might confirm that idea. There was more than one way to uncover the order's existence. Which brought him to the issue of the revenants. Obviously, the former Templars would know the location of the order's hideaways. It was reasonable to think that the enemy was resurrecting the dead in order to question them, to learn as much about the order and its various sites as possible. That also might explain some of the haphazardness to the individual attacks. Obviously, crisscrossing the Atlantic region wasn't the most effective way to assault the Order, but if they were forced to attack only the sites revealed to them in this fashion, they'd have little choice in the selection process. Yet, that didn't seem right to Cade. It was cumbersome, for one, and it certainly didn't guarantee success. From what he'd seen so far, their enemy had been well organized and pulled off its operations with skill and expertise. A foe like that wouldn't rely on the random chance that it might learn something from a half-crazed revenant. Full circle again. Back to the mole. Cade couldn't ignore the fact that somehow the enemy had learned about Ravensgate. Enough that it had been able to penetrate the defenses and slaughter every soldier stationed there, without leaving behind a single witness or physical clue for anyone to work with. That implied inside knowledge, as the preceptor had suggested. Frustrated and knowing his lack of understanding about the enemy's objective was probably coloring his ability to make sense of the details in front of him, Cade decided it was time to see if they could learn anything from the man they'd captured in Broward. Turning toward the manor house, he headed back in that direction with a determined stride and a fresh sense of expectation. The rest of his command squad was standing around the table in the observation area of Interrogation Room 4 when Cade arrived. Duncan moved to confront him the moment he entered the room.
"This is ridiculous."
He gestured over his shoulder to the prisoner they'd secured in the next room.
"That thing needs to be destroyed. Immediately."
"That thing, as you so quaintly put it, is a former member of this order, and you will treat him with the respect he deserves, no matter what his present condition. Is that clear?"
"Treat him with respect? You have got to be kidding me. The only way to do that is to put a bullet through his skull and let him rest. This is simply obscene."
It had been a long, difficult day, and Cade had had enough. He stepped close, crowding the other man with his bulk.
"Your opinion has been noted. Now shut up. My duty is to find the threat to our order and put a stop to it. I intend to do that. Right now, that man in there is our best hope of doing so, and I'm going to use him as much as I have to in order to accomplish that goal. If you don't like it, you can remove yourself from the room. Is that clear?"
They stared each other down for several tense seconds before the younger man looked away, nodded, and stepped aside. Cade crossed the room and looked through the one-way mirror into the interrogation room, where their guest was shackled to the wall. The chains were long enough to let him sit on the floor with his head between his knees, so Cade was unable to see his face, but he didn't need to.
"You recognize him, don't you?"
Riley grimaced, but nodded his head.
"George Winston.
Bravo team, wasn't he?"
"That's right. Assault squad, if I remember correctly."
"Olsen, what's happened since they brought him in?"
"He fought against the restraints at first, pulling on the chains as if he might get them to pop free through brute force alone. Ended up slamming himself against the wall a couple of times, too. When that didn't work, he tried chewing through his arm, but gave that up when he tasted his own flesh. Since then, he's just sat there waiting, as if he knows we'll come to him eventually. He's been that way for over an hour now."
"And just what exactly do we hope to learn from this thing?"
"I don't know how much we can learn, but right now he's the only clue we've got. If there's a possibility he can tell us anything, we have to try."
Cade looked at Riley.
"What do you think?"
"I wouldn't want to be trapped in that room if he gets loose. That's what I think."
"Yeah, agreed. Which is why I want you and Olsen on the other side of this doorway. If anything goes wrong, don't you hesitate. Get inside and put it down, clear?"
Both men nodded.
Duncan, get with Captain Stanton and find out if there's anyone here who served with Bravo Team during the last 5 years. If there is, I want him here ASAP. Having a priest nearby might not be a bad idea either. So see who you can scare up.
Will do.
Good. Let's move, people.
When Cade turned back to the mirror, he found Winston staring at it from the other side. Despite the fact that the mirror was one way, Cade was sure that the Revenant could see him. To test his theory, Cade took 3 steps to his right. Winston's head turned to track his movement, back to the left. Again, the Revenant watched him move. It seemed to Cade that in the Revenant's eyes, there was a deep sense of longing. But whether that longing was over what he had lost or simply the desire for his next meal, Cade couldn't tell. It took 15 minutes to get the details squared away. Duncan returned with 2 men in tow.
Father Garcon, Corporal Reese, this is Knight Commander Williams. I've explained to them both what we need. Reese spent 3 years with Bravo before being transferred here last year.
Garcon, a heavy-set balding man, was clearly the priest, which made the younger man dressed in technician's coveralls the former Bravo team member. Cade led him over to the observation window and let him get a good long look at the former knight on the other side.
How well did you know him?
We were on the same squad for about 18 months, sir. Spent some of our downtime together on leave.
So he would know you on sight?
Normally, I'd say yes, sir.
Good enough. Despite his present condition, the Winston you knew still exists in that shell. We need to reach him, get him to talk to us. I'm hoping that a familiar face might help him focus on who he was rather than on what he's become. So I need you to go into that room with us when the time comes. Can you do that?
Reese hesitated, swallowed hard, and nodded.
Good man.
The commander walked back over to the priest.
Thank you for coming, Father. My sergeant explained the situation to you.
The older man nodded, though he was clearly uncomfortable. He had studiously avoided glancing at the observation window since entering the room, and Cade noticed that Garcon's hands were trembling as he unpacked his portable mass kit on the table before him.
This man is a former knight of the Order. His belief in God might still survive his present condition. Your presence there could be a great comfort to him.
Garcon finally looked up, meeting Cade's gaze, and the commander immediately knew he had been mistaken. What he had taken for fear was actually anger.
And you, Knight Commander, shall I pray for you as well?
Just do your job, Father. I'll worry about my own soul, thanks.
Turning away from Garcon, Cade addressed the rest of the men in the room.
All right, let's do this.
When Olsen and Riley were in their places, Cade stepped inside the interrogation room and moved quickly to one side of the door, as Reese and Father Garcon did the same on the other side. Once they were in, Cade quickly closed the door behind them. Winston watched them enter the room without getting up. His gaze lingered on Reese for several moments. He caught sight of the purple stole around the elderly priest's neck, but that was his only reaction. Neither man elicited more than a mild reaction. The Revenant turned to look at Cade. He stared at him for a long moment, unmoving. Then, he went berserk. Winston surged to his feet, straining at his chains and gnashing his teeth. Reese and Garcon recoiled, moving for the door, but Cade remained steady, knowing the chains would hold. He slammed to the floor, only to thrash around wildly as he tried to pull himself closer to Cade. Cade turned to face the one-way mirror.
I need a knife, a sharp one, and a pressure bandage.
It took only a few moments before the door opened, and the 2 items he requested were slipped inside. Cade took them, withdrew the commando-style combat knife from its sheath, and tested the edge. A fine line of blood welled up where he ran his thumb along the blade. It would do. The creature settled down at the sight of the blood and watched Cade closely, as if sensing his intent. Winston's hunger was like a phantom presence, palpable in its intensity. Under the creature's watchful gaze, Cade knelt and rolled up the cuff of his right pant leg. He set the knife's edge against the skin of his calf and drew it down sharply. A wafer-thin piece of flesh rolled up behind the blade and fell to the floor. Blood flowed, hot and sharp. Cade gritted his teeth against the pain and slapped the pressure bandage over the wound. Once he was certain the bandage would stop the bleeding, he bent over and carefully picked up his offering. The creature watched him, his eyes wide and staring, his hunger a pulsing need that filled the room. he'd cut the strip in half and tossed one section to Winston. The Revenant's hand shot out and snatched the offering out of midair. He shoved it in his mouth and chewed quickly. With that, Rhys had seen enough. He banged on the door and exited the room quickly when Olsen opened it up. Surprisingly, Father Garçon remained inside. After feeding on even that small piece of flesh, an immediate change seemed to come over Winston. His gaze grew more alert, his attention more focused on the man standing before him.
Now listen to me, George. I know you can understand me if you try.
The Revenant's gaze never left the remaining strip of human flesh Cade held in his other hand.
I'm going to ask you some more questions. If you answer them, I'll give you this.
Cade held up the flesh. If the Revenant could have salivated, Cade was certain he would have.
Do you understand me, George?
Slowly, Winston raised his gaze from the meat to look Cade in the eyes. With a barely noticeable twitch, he indicated his understanding.
Good. Who did this to you, George? Do you know who it was? I'm sorry, George. I didn't understand. Try again.
It was obvious that he was trying to cooperate, but the damage to his vocal cords had progressed too far for him to be understood. But Cade wasn't yet ready to give up. It was clear that the Revenant still possessed the intelligence he had held in life. The person that had once been George Winston was still locked inside that body, struggling to get out. If he could, he should be able to tell them what they wanted to know. But first, Cade would have to figure out a way to allow that to happen. As it turned out, it was the Revenant himself who found the solution. With one hand, he traced the number 9 on the floor beside him.
9.
The Revenant repeated the gesture, his eyes locked on the strip of flesh Cade still held in his hand.
There were 9 of them?
The Revenant's head twitched, and his hands clenched into fists as he sought to maintain control. His hunger was growing. Calming himself, he nodded.
Okay. The number 9.
Cade didn't understand what Winston was referring to, so he moved on, hoping a different question might elicit a more understandable response.
What did they want?
The creature suddenly lunged at Cade, his hunger taking his self-control. Cade didn't even flinch.
Do you know where they are, George? Help me find them, George. Tell me where they've gone. Help me get the ones who did this to you.
Winston didn't respond, just went back to staring at the flesh in Cade's hand.
You've got to tell me, George. I need your help. Do you know where they are?
Nothing.
Come on, George. Don't stop now.
Still nothing. Just that stare. And the hunger it conveyed. Realizing that he would get nothing further from the Revenant until it had fed again, Cade tossed him the thin strip of flesh. Like a rabid dog, the creature threw itself onto the morsel, its eyes alight with an unholy hunger. But as Winston raised the meat to his lips, he suddenly froze in mid-motion, his hand halfway to his mouth. He stayed that way for several long moments. Cade signaled for the others to hold still. As they watched, the former Templar shook his head violently, like a dog shaking itself free of water. He slowly lowered the hand holding the morsel to his side. Moving slowly, Cade crouched so that he was on the same level as the Revenant.
What was that? What'd you say, George?
Impatiently, Cade moved closer. In the next room, Olsen and Riley both went on alert, but didn't interfere with their commander.
Please, George, one more time.
This time, Cade understood. What he had first taken for gibberish was actually a two-word phrase, repeated frantically over and over again several times. Cade stared into the other man's eyes and saw hope there. For what seemed like the longest time, neither man moved. Then, in one swift motion, Cade drew his gun and shot the former Templar in the head. The Revenant's body crashed to the floor, unmoving, his gaze now fixed permanently on the wall behind him.
Godspeed.
They spent the rest of that day and the majority of the next wading through database after database in an effort to correlate the scant leads they had against lists of known enemies of the Order. The initial threat assessment had come back with over 400 groups or individuals who had reason to want to harm the Order, from rival religious groups to magical societies that openly worship the devil. From there, they'd begun the process of correlating the list of names with other known facts, such as the ability to raise a revenant, proximity to the locations of the attacks, and any connection they could find with the number 9. By early evening, they still had way too many possibilities to contend with. It was going to be a long night. They needed more information, more details to help narrow the search. The hoped-for forensic results came back from Ravensgate late the next day, but ultimately proved unhelpful, confirming only what they already knew. But some person or persons unknown had assaulted the compound, murdered everyone on the grounds without the use of modern weaponry, then disappeared back into the night without a trace. The team was getting frustrated, the long hours of research without anything to show for it wearing at their nerves. They needed something else to happen if they were going to make any progress. In the early hours of their third day at Falkenberg, something did. Just after 3 a.m., Captain Stanton sent word that the Broadmoor Commandery in upstate New York had just been attacked. This time, with the troops on full alert, they were able to repel the attackers after a fierce firefight. According to the base commander, they had a lot of information for Commander Williams. The plane was fueled and the team's equipment loaded. With thanks to Captain Stanton and his men, Echo Team departed just as the sun was coming up over the horizon. A car and driver was waiting for them when they arrived in Syracuse just over an hour and a half later. They passed the ride in silence, not wanting to talk about the investigation in front of a stranger, fellow Templar or not, the suspicion of an inside informant still prominent in their thoughts. They were met at the gate by the acting commander, Major Barnes, who led them onto the property and explained what his men had encountered during the battle the evening before. He told a harrowing tale of a wall of fog that enveloped the grounds, of spectral creatures that hunted in its depths. He told of their frantic efforts to throw back the invaders, only to be beaten time and time again. He summed things up with a look of disgust.
By the time it was over, we had 35 men dead, 67 wounded, and all we have to show for our efforts was a single corpse.
One of theirs?
Yeah, somebody made a lucky shot, it seems. We're not sure why, but shortly after he was killed, the fog dissipated, and then the attack faded away to nothing.
Let's have a look at the body.
The corpse had been left where it had fallen, some 100 yards away from the entry in the open grass. The man had been in his early 30s, with long black hair and a well-kept beard. He was dressed in a thick robe complete with a hood, something that looked like it belonged in the Middle Ages, beneath which he wore a t-shirt and jeans. The bullet wound in his chest told the rest of the story, but it was the signet ring on his left hand that drew Cade's attention. A ring with a skeletal snake chasing its own tail, surrounding the number 9. Known as Ouroboros, the snake symbolized many things in many cultures. The circular nature of life, the cyclical power of the universe, the idea that all things are renewed through entropy and decay. He had no idea what the 9 represented, but at least he now understood why Winston had been focused on the number. Cade knew that he was looking at his first concrete clue to the attacker's identities. Assuming that the dead man had been the sorcerer who had summoned the ghostly fog, it seemed logical to guess that his death had banished the creatures back to their own realm of existence. Around them, Barnes's men were hard at work collecting the bodies of the dead, both those that had perished at the hands of the enemy and those that had risen again, only to be sent to their final rest by their fellow knights. It was a gruesome sight, one that filled Cade with unease, for he knew that he could have been investigating another deserted commandery if Barnes's troops had not succeeded in repelling the assault. The thought prompted a question.
Any idea what their objective was?
We're not entirely certain. As near as I can tell, the attack was a diversion, designed to hide whatever it was they were doing in the cemetery. We found a block and tackle set up over a grave, but we haven't had time to look into it further yet.
Show me.
Barnes led them across the property and into the cemetery. It was a large one, with graves dating back more than 100 years, yet the one they finally stopped at wasn't more than a year old. The inscription read simply, Julius Spencer, 1944 to 2003. The coffin had been dug out of the grave and its lid torn open, but the body of the former knight remained resting peacefully inside. The aforementioned block and tackle lay discarded in the grass a few feet away. Unlike the scene at Templeton, with its many desecrated graves, here only this particular one had been disturbed. As Riley questioned the locals for more details, Cade stepped away from the others and used his sight to survey the scene around him. With it, he could see that the graveyard existed in the beyond, just as it did here, but that was where the similarity ended. In the real world, the graveyard was a well-manicured place of respect and remembrance. In the beyond, it was a wild, desolate locale. The grass was overgrown, knee-high in most places, obscuring many of the gravestones. The stones themselves were cracked and worn, the writing on their surfaces obscured by overgrowths of fungi and mold. The trees, in the real world lush and healthy, were disease-ridden hulks in the beyond, their leafless branches stretching down almost to the ground, their skeletal forms stark against the gray sky. Off to his left, the brooding form of the manor house stood watch in the distance. A flicker of motion caught Cade's eye. When he turned to find it, he saw a shadowy figure standing out among the gravestones. Before he could get a good look, the figure moved off, disappearing from view among the markers. He suspected he knew the spirit's identity, however. Later, he would verify that suspicion. It was time they found some answers to this puzzle. After ordering his men to get some rest, Cade retired to his own room, ostensibly to do the same. In truth, the commander had much different plans. Once inside, he closed his bedroom door but left it unlocked. Moving into the bathroom, he took the mirror down off the wall and returned with it to the bedroom, placing it flat on the floor next to the bed. He took a pad of paper out of the desk, wrote a short note to Riley explaining what he intended to do, and placed the note prominently on his pillow. He left both of his guns in his kit bag. Firearms didn't work in the beyond. While he didn't exactly understand why, he had come to the conclusion it had something to do with the fact that the spiritual nature of the place didn't mesh well with the mechanical nature of the gun itself. This seemed to be supported by the fact that melee weapons, powered only by the strength and determination of the wielder, worked without a problem. In fact, the more emotional the attacker, the more damage the blow inflicted. Cade knelt on the prie-dieu that stood in the corner of his room and took a few moments to prepare himself mentally for his journey across the barrier. Reaching the other side was always a difficult and draining task. Without a clear head, he could end up getting lost or not having the strength to make the return journey. The beyond was still very much a mystery to Cade, despite his many journeys there. As nearly as he could tell, it was a shadow realm that existed close to the real world in time and space, but forever separated by a wall of energy he had come to call the barrier. Like the mystical purgatory, it was inhabited by the shades of the dead, those that for one reason or another had not moved on to a more lasting rest. Other creatures inhabited the beyond as well, dark, twisted creatures that hunted the shades and roamed the land in great predatory packs. For lack of a better name, Cade called them specters, after the mythical creatures of legend. He avoided them wherever and whenever he could. The fact that Spencer's spirit remained in the area around his grave told Cade that he would probably find the former Templar close by, on the other side of the barrier. Cade intended to make the crossing with the hope of contacting Spencer's shade and finding out just what had made him so interesting to the opposition. Cade strapped his sword across his back in its habitual carry position and moved to the other side of the bed. Without further delay, he stepped through the surface of the mirror. The squad members were assigned to guest rooms identical to Cade's in the east wing of the house. The rooms were small with a minimum of furnishings, a narrow bed, a desk and chair, and a kneeler in the corner for prayer time. The events of the last 24 hours had worn Olsen out, and he intended to get some rest while he had the chance. Rack time was a sparse commodity in Cade's unit, and who knew when they would be called out again. He placed his computer equipment on the nearby desk and hung his gun off the edge of the headboard, where it would be within easy reach. He turned out the lights, stretched out on the bed, and tried to get some sleep. Unfortunately, sleep was more elusive than he had hoped. He'd reached that stage of being so overtired that his mind refused to shut down. It was still working at the problem of whom or what they were facing, and worrying the issue like a dog with a bone. Some research might be just what he needed. He brought his laptop over to the bed and fired it up. As he'd expected, the room itself did not contain any ports with which to plug into the Order's servers. Those were reserved for the librarian research areas, the better to monitor what individual knights were doing online. But that hadn't hampered his net-based activities in quite some time. It's amazing what a little knowledge and a properly configured wireless network card can do. 5 minutes later, he was clandestinely disguised as an authorized net spider and roaming through the Order's personnel records. He started with the name on the grave they'd visited earlier. It didn't take him long to find Spencer's records. He went through the man's personal history, noting his middle-class background and advanced education. He'd spent time in the armed forces before being recruited to join the Order. Olsen next turned his attention to the list of duty assignments, looking for anything out of place, anything unusual that might have caused the attackers to single out Spencer's grave from all the others in the cemetery. One notation in particular caught his eye. Olsen stared at it, thinking. Then he got up, left his room, and walked down the hallway past several doors until he came to the room to which Riley had been assigned.
Tell me why I shouldn't kill you where you stand, Olsen.
You spent time at the Birmingham Commandery before joining ACO, didn't you?
This can't wait until morning.
No, answer the question.
Yeah, 3 years. It was hot and humid, and that was the best part of the assignment.
Nick headed back toward his own room.
Come here and check this out. I think we got a problem.
Riley disappeared back inside his room, then emerged again a few moments later, fully dressed. He strode down the hall to Nick's room and peered over his shoulder as he brought up Spencer's personnel records. The man's service record and photograph appeared on the screen.
Recognize him?
No. Should I?
Yes. You both supposedly served in Birmingham at the same time.
Riley had a near photographic memory for faces and names. According to the record, Spencer had served 5 years at the Birmingham Commandery. During that time, the two men would have had to have run into each other at some point. Even if they were assigned to opposite shifts of duty, they would have seen each other while off duty or during worship times. The commandery in Birmingham just wasn't that big. Olsen dug a little deeper into the records. The landscape of the beyond was constantly shifting, like a funhouse mirror, hauntingly familiar, yet intimately strange. Sometimes it was vastly different from where he had entered the rift. Other times, it was as alike as a photograph and its negative. Tonight, it was the latter. The commandery in which he emerged was a mirror reflection of the one he had just left, though with one major difference. Here, the inevitable passage of entropy was clearly visible. Like a canvas painted with depression and pain, everything was hung with a patina of decay. Dark stains covered walls that seeped a foul-smelling sweat, while thick cobwebs and layers of dust hid the ceiling from view. The scent of mold hung heavily in the air. Underneath the mold, other, less identifiable but equally unpleasant odors lingered. Great gaping holes littered the floor of the hallway. Through them he could see the floor below, and in one notable case, all the way to the basement deep beneath the house. He cautiously descended the stairs, expecting them to collapse beneath him at any moment, and was finally able to reach the ground floor without mishap after several slow, agonizing minutes. From there, he quickly made his way to the front door and out into the night. He set off across the lawn, moving toward the graveyard on the far edge of the estate, just as he had earlier in the day. Where in the real world the grass was vibrantly green, here it was limp and lifeless. And like everything else in the beyond, it was one of a thousand subtle shades of gray. Great burrow-like holes littered the area, displaying tunnels that disappeared into the dank earth below. Tunnels that seemed to devour even the scant light cast by the feeble stars above. Cade didn't like their looks and made wide sweeping detours to avoid them. It was a long walk, longer than he remembered, and therefore suspect in the constantly shifting landscape. Though at last he came to the cemetery. The waist-high gate of iron that guarded the entrance in the real world had been torn down. But here in the beyond, it still hung on its rusted frame. Cade moved through the gate onto the cemetery grounds. In the living world, the grave markers were carefully tended. Here, many of them were split in two. Their top halves lay discarded and forgotten in the uncut grass, their bottom portions caked with strange growths and odd lichens that obscured the inscriptions. The sickly light of a waning moon cast shadows across the scene, shadows that seemed to weave and dance around him. A sudden motion out of the corner of his eye caught his attention. Reacting on instinct, Cade spun to his left, The blade that should have severed his arm at the shoulder merely nicked his skin as he turned. A dark, barely glimpsed figure dashed past him and disappeared behind a nearby mausoleum.
I mean you no harm!
Despite his statement, he drew his own sword so he would be ready to defend himself if and where necessary. There was no telling how the other would react to his intrusion into the beyond. His reception had been less than welcome by other denizens of the place. Cade moved closer to Spencer's grave. Twice more, he was attacked. Twice more, he managed to twist out of the way of the deadly weapon at the last moment. Still, he didn't attempt to attack the other man in turn. He suspected the Shade was Spencer, and he needed his cooperation, not his animosity. He was also beginning to believe that the man's attacks were nothing more than a test, a challenge to his worthiness. Each time the other man had him dead to rights, yet Cade had managed to elude the killing blow. With a confidence born of this new consideration, Cade moved toward the figure waiting for him by the grave, a figure with a naked longsword visible in its right hand. Cade stopped, several feet away. He replaced his own sword in its sheath and let his hands fall to his side with his palms open, clearly showing his lack of hostile intent. The two men studied each other. Cade waited, enduring the inspection.
Why have you come here?
I need your help.
The living are not welcome here.
The Order is under assault. I need to understand who's behind the attacks and what they're after. I believe you can give me the answers I need.
I cannot help you.
You must! Our brothers are dying. Our dead are being ripped from their graves, forced to walk the earth. You know who is behind this. You must help us.
The Shade continued to walk away.
By your vow, by your pledge to the Lord, I demand that you honor my request. Let each as well as he can bear another's burdens so that one may honor another.
Do not quote the rule to me. You do not know what it is like to wander this place. You do not know the unrest, the yearning for finality that I have endured since coming here. You don't know the horrors that I've seen. After my faithful service, I'm reduced to this. You should bear my burdens.
If my taking your place could save the lives of those in my care, then I would be the first to volunteer. But I don't have that option. If not for the Order, then do it for your brother soldiers, those who fought and died in name of the cause as earnestly as you did. They believed. They gave their lives willingly. Don't let their sacrifices be in vain. Don't let their rest be shattered in the way that your own has. With your help, I can stop this. I know I can.
For a moment, Cade thought he had failed. The dead Templar raised his weapon, his face contorted in anger. Cade braced himself for the battle to come, but something in his earnest plea must have finally reached the other man, for the blow Cade anticipated never came. The former Templar slowly lowered his weapon and nodded in defeat.
Very well. I will help you. But you will not like what you hear.
This is interesting.
Olsen was pointing to a particular line on the screen.
A training assignment? We all have those, so what?
One that lasted 2 years?
2 years? That doesn't make any sense.
Both men knew that such assignments rarely, if ever, lasted more than 6 months. If you couldn't cut it in your new unit in that time frame, you were transferred elsewhere.
Is there any more information?
When Olsen tried to access the detailed information, he struck a command prompt that asked for a user ID and password. He plugged in his standard codes, fully expecting to gain access, only to be bumped back out again with an error message that informed him that the information he was trying to reach was classified. He thought for a moment, then inserted a second set of codes. The classified warning blinked back at them from the screen for a second time.
Try mine.
Riley's failed as well.
So much for that.
We're not finished yet.
When the prompt came up a third time, Olsen inserted Cade's personal codes.
The commander would have your scalp if he knew you had his codes.
I know. That's why we aren't going to tell him, right?
Mum's the word.
But once again, the security system kicked them out. Olsen was frustrated, but by no means beaten. He had an ace up his sleeve for defeating the system security, but he was holding it in reserve until he was certain they were onto something. For the moment, Echo Team's security expert decided to take another route. He called up a list of the commanderies that had suffered assaults in the last several days. Then he accessed the property records for each, creating a list of all of the Order's members who had been interred at the cemeteries on those sites. He then instructed the computer to hunt through the service records for those individuals, flagging every member who had a long-duration training assignment similar to Spencer's. 10 minutes later, the computer spat back a list of 5 names. Each and every one of them had been assigned to Birmingham for the same training assignment. But when Olsen tried to dig deeper into the individual records, he received the same results. Any detailed information regarding those assignments was classified, and Riley, assigned to the same location during the same time period, didn't recognize any of the names on the list.
Can you check that assignment against the service records of the entire order, using today's date?
Why?
I want to see how many other men there are, and where they're located now.
That kind of search might set off a few alarms.
The system thinks you're Cade. What do you care?
Good enough for me.
Olsen set the process in motion, then sat back to wait for the results. The two men talked over various theories regarding the attacks and the half hour it took for the computer to complete the task. When it had, they were faced with a list of 20 names. Every one of them was assigned to the Preceptor's Commandery in Bristol, Rhode Island. None of them were familiar to either of the Echo Team members. Olsen tried to use Cade's passcodes to access the individual records and learn more, but even that gambit failed. He was not to be deterred, however. He had the sense that he had a major piece of the puzzle right in front of him, if he only had the wherewithal to follow it to its source, and he fully intended to do just that. It was time to use his ace in the hole.
I've been saving this for a real emergency. Something tells me this is one.
Early in his relationship with the Order, Olsen had been assigned to the unit in charge of developing the Templar technological infrastructure. During that time, he had used his knowledge of network systems to bury a back door deep behind the security systems, a hidden port of entry into the heart of the Order's framework. It could only be used once, but when it was, it allowed Olsen to roam around the system as a root administrator with complete access to all but the most fortified sections of the database. With the help of the back door and a slick little utility that masqueraded as an authorized net spider, Olsen broke through. An entire unit was hidden there. Neither of the men had been aware of its existence, and they pored over the information with a great degree of shock and surprise. What they had in front of them was a standard TO&E. The table of organization and equipment was a document that identified the unit's rank structure, mission, and arms and equipment. This particular unit was identified as the Custodes Veritatis, or Guardians of Truth. From what they could determine, its primary mission was to protect and preserve the holy relics that the Order had obtained over the years, everything from Veronica's Veil to the Staff of Moses. Knight Commander Nigel Stone was listed as the unit commander, and all 20 of the previous names they had uncovered showed up on the current duty roster. The unit's historical records showed that all 5 of the deceased had been members at one time or another as well.
Who does Stone report to?
A few keystrokes later, they had their answer.
Son of a...
My feelings exactly. Boss sure ain't gonna be happy about this.
The commandery was under attack.
Damn!
The two men grabbed their weapons and rushed out into the corridor. The computer, and the damning evidence it contained, forgotten on the desk inside.
What are they looking for?
Cade and his companion were seated on the cracked surface of a marble sarcophagus, where they had settled after the Shade of the Dead Templar had finally agreed to talk.
The Spear of Destiny.
Cade sat back in surprise. The Spear of Destiny was the mythical name given to the lance the Roman centurion Longinus used to pierce the side of Christ while he hung on the cross, thus fulfilling the Old Testament prophecies. It was also known as the Spear of Longinus, or the Lance of Mauritius. Cade knew that historically the lance had allegedly been possessed by a series of successful military leaders, including Alaric, Attila the Hun, Charlemagne, and even Hitler, all of whom claimed it was the power of the lance that led them to victory.
Why do they want it?
Spencer simply looked at him, not bothering to respond. The Templar commander realized the futility of his question. Reviewing what he knew about the lance, the why of it all quickly became obvious. There was a legend that whoever possessed the weapon would be able to conquer the world. Napoleon attempted to obtain the lance after the Battle of Austerlitz, but it had been smuggled out of the city prior to the start of the fight, and he never got hold of it. Charlemagne carried the spear through 47 successful battles, but died when he accidentally dropped it. Barbarossa met the same fate only a few minutes after it slipped out of his hands while he was crossing a stream. The modern history of the spear wasn't as well documented. Somehow, it eventually wound up in the possession of the House of the Habsburg and was placed in the Hofburg Treasure House in 1912, where Hitler was later to discover it. A rabid student of the occult and fully aware of the legend attached to it, Hitler had the spear moved to St. Catherine's Church in Berlin shortly after he came to power. As the Americans and Russians advanced on Berlin, he had it moved again, this time to an underground bunker to protect it from Allied bombing raids. That bunker fell to the U.S. on April 30, 1945, and an army officer took possession of the weapon. Consistent with the legend, Hitler committed suicide in his bunker just 80 hours after he lost control of the spear. General Patton was particularly interested in the weapon and took the time to have its authenticity traced. His fanaticism on the subject was eventually brought to Eisenhower's attention, however, who found the whole subject distasteful. If Cade remembered correctly, it was Eisenhower who returned the lance to its rightful location, the Hofburg Treasure House in Vienna, where it was supposedly still on display. If the legends were true, and the necromancer and his allies gained control of the weapon, they had a much bigger problem on their hands. But one issue kept nagging at Cade. He seemed to remember both the Hofburg Museum and the Vatican itself claiming to control the real lance. If that was true, why was the Council of Nine attacking Templar commanderies looking for the weapon? He put the question to Spencer. The answer was not what he had expected.
Because the Council knows that for the last 50 years it has rested in a vault controlled by a secret unit within our own order.
Duncan was asleep when the emergency alarm sounded, but was out of bed and ready within seconds. Weapons in hand, he rushed from his bedroom just in time to join Olsen and Riley as they emerged from Cade's room across the hall.
The Knight Commander?
Not in his room.
The three of them dashed down the stairs and emerged in the grand foyer, just in time to meet a group of revenants as they crashed through the front door. The Knights moved as one, splitting into a V-shaped formation. Riley took point with Duncan on his left and Olsen on his right. Revenants never stood a chance. Caught in the concentrated fire of the three knights, the creatures were quickly cut to ribbons. The three men took up positions facing out the open doorway. What they saw outside momentarily took their breath away. Cade emerged from the beyond to find himself in an unused room on the second floor of the Broadmoor Commandery. As always, the mirror he used as an exit point shattered violently with his passage, and he paused for a moment, waiting to see if anyone would come to investigate the sound of breaking glass. He moved down the hallway until he reached a window. His viewpoint gave out onto the front entrance to the manor house and the grounds beyond, meaning that Cade was in the east wing, exactly opposite where he had started. In the light of the floodlights that were mounted on the roof, Cade could see revenants dashing across the lawn, only to be thrown back or brought down by the concentrated firepower of the knights guarding the front entrance. The front gate lay in ruins, and more revenants poured through the gap even as he watched. Several could be seen gorging themselves on the corpses of those who had defended the gate, next to the smoking ruin of the security shack. The missing men from the Templeton Commandery had come home. Despite the fact that he was unarmed, Cade never hesitated. He turned and ran for the stairs at the other end of the hall, intent on joining the fray. As he moved, the flicker of light caught his eye. A portal had formed in the middle of the front lawn, a silver mirror-like disc of shimmering power some 10 feet across. Its surface rippled and swirled as if something were disturbing it from below. Cade dashed down the hall and stepped out through a set of French doors. He found himself on a balcony over the portico that guarded the entrance to the manor house. A group of knights were crouched behind the low wall that ran around the balcony's edge, firing everything they had at the portal below. Cade was just in time to witness the birth of a nightmare. A hand came first, a hand the size of a small horse, twisted and gnarled, the color of melting lead. It was four-fingered, and each finger ended in a vicious claw. The hand was joined by another, this one on the other side of the portal. Its fingers grasped the edge of the lawn, and the creature slowly pulled itself into view. Cade faltered to a halt as he stared in dismay at the demon. It stood well over 20 feet tall and was humanoid in appearance. Its skin was the color of a pig left too long on the roasting spit, deep crimson and black, and it glistened wetly in the floodlights. Its head was misshapen, like wax that had rested too close to a fire, and four large, bulbous eyes stared lustfully at the world around it, from within the depths of what could only charitably be called a face. As he watched, a group of Templar defenders emerged from around the corner of the west wing and began firing at it. In reply, it reached out, grabbed a nearby Suburban in one large fist, and hurled it at the Knights. Cade ran to the wall and looked out of it, knowing he had little time to find what he needed. He looked beyond the oncoming beast, searching for a spot back from the center of the fray in a place of reasonable safety. He strained to see through the flashes of gunfire and the glare from the spotlights on the roof above.
There.
A sorcerer stood beneath the sheltering branches of a large elm tree near the wall surrounding the estate. His head was bowed in concentration, and his hands moved rhythmically through the air in front of him. Having found his target, Cade glanced beside him. The nearest soldier was firing shot after shot into the approaching demon with a standard-issue M14. It would have to do. Cade grabbed the rifle from the startled soldier and rushed 20 feet farther along the parapet, shouldering the weapon in the process. He did his best to ignore both the approaching behemoth and the confusion of the soldiers around him. He settled in for the shot. The view through the scope showed his target in more detail. He was dressed exactly like the man Cade had examined earlier, right down to the robe and the ring on one hand. Cade eyeballed the distance between them as roughly 350 meters. The demon moved another 15 feet closer with a single step. Cade ignored everything but the target.
Steady.
His attention narrowed to a pinpoint, his entire world reduced to the figure and the reticle of his scope. The demon stepped off the grass and onto the asphalt, less than 20 feet from where Cade perched on the rooftop. Cade's bullet leapt from the gun and smashed into the flesh of the demon's left arm as it swung to the side in a random arc.
Shit!
Cade prepared to fire again, but the demon had closed in, blocking his shot at the sorcerer who had summoned it. He'd have to get higher in order to fire over the creature's shoulder. There was only one choice. Ignoring the fact that the demon was only scant feet away, Cade scrambled up onto the wall in front of him. He brought the weapon back up into firing position and sighted once more on his target. He was horribly exposed and knew it, yet he had no other choice. The demon reached for him with one four-fingered hand, its claws gleaming in the floodlights. The sorcerer looked up, and Cade stared through the scope directly into the man's eyes.
Goodbye.
At almost the same instant, the demon's gnarled hand wrapped itself around Cade's waist and yanked him off the parapet. The creature began to crush the life out of him simply by squeezing its fist. He fought against the creature's grip, but it was like punching a steel band. It was all he could do to keep air in his lungs. The demon raised its fist higher to get a better look. Hot, fetid breath washed across Cade's face. Four inhuman eyes regarded Cade with glee as the demon's mouth opened wide. By the edge of the estate, the sorcerer lay on the ground, bleeding from the chest. Slowly, all life left his body. In the same instant, the portal through which the demon had been summoned suddenly reversed its flow, becoming a conduit back into the next. The demon faltered and came to a stop. Involuntarily, it took a step backward. Something was pulling at the creature from behind. Reluctantly, the demon turned its attention to this new problem. In that moment, the portal pulsed a second time, and the demon was yanked off its feet from the sheer force of the suction it generated. In surprise, the creature opened its fist. Cade fell. His arms reached out, desperate to find purchase on something before his body smashed itself against the unforgiving ground below. As he fell past the balcony, his fingers brushed up against the edge of the stone railing, and he instinctively grabbed at it. With a bone-jarring impact, he managed to stop his fall, only to find himself hanging by his arms two stories above an enraged demon. The rest of Echo's command unit watched in stunned amazement as the demon suddenly slammed to the ground face first. It pushed itself up on its arms, only to fall forward again as something began to drag it slowly from behind. The which was rather amazing, since they could see that there was nothing there. Slowly but surely, the demon continued slipping backward away from the Templars.
What's happening?
Someone has lost control of the portal. It's reversed itself. Anything that entered through it is about to go back out again in a big hurry, including that ugly son of a bitch in front of us.
Above them, undetected by his fellow team members, Cade slowly began to lose his grip on the railing. He searched for some sort of foothold, something to support his weight for the fraction of a second he needed to regain his grip on the railing above. Unfortunately, that particular section of the wall was slick with polished stone. His left hand suddenly lost its grip. His body twisted outward with the momentum, putting more strain on his right hand. He was turned partially toward the front gate, and the position afforded him a view of the demon as it was dragged inexorably back toward the portal. A twisted rope of shimmering energy extended from the rapidly closing portal and across the lawn to wrap around the demon's legs just below its knees. It pulsed and pulled in time with the shrinking opening to the portal. It wouldn't be long before the demon was hauled back to its own plane of existence, back to where it belonged. Revenant still roamed the grounds, but the element of surprise had long since worn off, and the knights had gained the upper hand. This time, the Templars had won.
Though I might not be around to celebrate.
Luckily, several of the retreating knights on the balcony above had seen Cade's heroic stand and rushed back out after the danger passed to see what had become of him. Their discovery was just in time to keep him from falling to the ground two stories below. As he was pulled up over the edge of the balcony, movement out by the front gate caught his eye. A billowing cloud of fog hung nearly 10 feet in the air, throbbing and rolling in several directions at once. Cade could see faces appear and disappear within its depths, each one seeming in agony, their mouths open wide in silent screams. A hooded figure stepped out of its depths and lifted its head to look in Cade's direction. It raised one hand, as if in recognition. The necromancer and the Templar commander stared at each other across the distance. A wave of cold washed across Cade's form. He knew instinctively that he was looking at the individual directly responsible for the attacks on the Templar strongholds. Here was the enemy he sought. He triggered his sight. An additional aura of crimson, gray, and black surrounded the necromancer, mixing with the grayish-white shade of the sorcerer's own aura. The sight of it made Cade's heart cry out in horrific pain. He knew that pattern. He didn't know how or why, he just knew instinctively what it meant. Without ever having seen it before, Cade knew that he was looking at the mark of the adversary. In the aftermath of the attack, Cade and his men caught a few moments of privacy and compared notes. Olsen explained what he and Riley had found, revealing the existence of a special unit in the Order and to whom it reported. Cade, in turn, told them about his encounter with Spencer and the Shade's belief that whoever was attacking them was doing so in order to locate and retrieve the Spear of Longinus. Things were finally starting to make some sense, though they were still no closer to uncovering the identity of those behind it all. Now, 2 hours later, Cade moved throughout the first floor, stopping briefly to talk to the defenders. His very presence, normally something that made most of the men nervous, was a welcome balm to their spirit. Knowing as they did that it was the Knight Commander alone who had turned the tide of battle in their favor. While he walked, Cade checked on the preparations being made, making certain they were covered in the unlikely event that the Necromancer and his allies tried again. He reassured the wounded, letting them know that the Order's medical staff would be with them as soon as possible, and seeing to it that any mortally wounded soldiers were immediately removed to the infirmary. When he was finished, he moved to the second floor and did the same. Eventually, he ended up on the balcony overlooking the entrance to the manor house, watching the recovery team move across the wide patch of front lawn as they checked for any revenants that might still be alive. Still intent on watching the recovery team, Cade absentmindedly removed his phone from his belt.
Williams.
Commander Cade Williams.
Cade went instantly on alert. His phone was unlisted. No one but the senior Templar commanders and his own sergeants knew he could be reached at this number.
Who is this?
My name is Nigel Stone. Can I assume I am speaking with Knight Commander Williams?
Yeah, this is Williams. Now who are you, what do you want, and how'd you get his number?
Easy, Commander. I'll be happy to answer your questions, but one at a time, please. First, are you alone?
Yeah, I'm alone.
Good. As I mentioned, my name is Nigel Stone. Knight Commander Stone, to be precise. My compliments to your Sergeant Olson. Very few individuals have ever managed to penetrate the security around my unit.
You're the head of the Custodes Veritatis.
Correct. And I think it is time we talked.
You've got that right. It's a dangerous game you're playing, you realize? Especially if your unit is the target of these attacks.
Rather than have you continue to route through our files, I thought it might be best to share what we know to date and work together on this.
I'm listening.
Not on the phone. I would prefer to meet face to face. While we still remain one step ahead of our attackers, they are closing the gap, and I'm concerned our security may be breached.
Why? What do you know that I don't?
As I said, I'd prefer to discuss this in person. Are you familiar with Otter Lake?
Yeah.
It was a small mountain town north of Utica, about 3 hours' drive from the Broadmoor Commandery where Cade was. Stone gave him an address.
I'll meet you there at 6 this evening. I'll expect you and possibly one of your squad members, but no one else. If I see you've ignored my instructions, I'll be gone, and you'll be back to square one.
What's the matter, Stone? Don't you trust me?
Right now, I don't trust anyone.
2 hours later, Cade made excuses to the local commander and set off for Otter Lake. He'd made the decision to take Duncan along with him to the meeting. Olson and Riley would remain nearby, sequestered in a local motel in case they got into trouble. For all he knew, Stone could be behind it all, and Cade wanted his men close by just in case. They traveled north until Albany, then headed west. Just past Utica, they left the four-lane highway behind in favor of a two-lane state road that would take them up into the Adirondack Mountains to Otter Lake. Otter Lake was a small mountain community that was home to less than 500 residents in the summer and considerably less during the hard winter months. It was on Route 28, a road notorious for its impassability in the midst of winter storms. And as luck would have it, the rain began pounding against their windows halfway through the trip. A few miles south of their destination, they began looking for a motel. It didn't take long to find one that would suit their purposes. A central lodge surrounded by individual cabins just off the main stretch of road. A neon sign blinked vacancy, and Kay turned into the parking lot. It was close enough that Olson and Riley could be counted on to reach them quickly in an emergency. The four of them assembled at the table in the common room of the cabin they were assigned.
I don't expect to be gone more than an hour, two at the most. If you don't hear from us by 8 o'clock, assume that something went wrong. Get some backup from Major Barnes and come on in after us. If things go completely to shit, you're gonna need to go to Bristol and confront Michaels. Make him tell you where the Lance is and what he intends to do to protect it. Threaten him if you must. Do whatever you have to, but don't let that weapon fall into the enemy's hands, or we're all up Schitt's Creek. That's an order. Understood?
The two sergeants nodded in agreement. Kate took a few moments to study the local map Olson had snagged from the hotel clerk, then was ready to go. The map showed that the address Nigel Stone had given them was only another 15 miles farther north of their position, but the winding road and bad weather forced them to go slowly and kept their pace to a minimum. As Cade drove, Duncan double-checked both of their MP5s and made certain they had ample ammunition. The house was a newly built two-story structure with a stucco and fieldstone facing. Several arched windows decorated with lintels and set in wide majestic gables looked out onto the front lawn. Cade stepped up to the door. When no one answered, he tried the door. At the touch of his hand, it swung open slowly. He and Duncan looked at each other. An unspoken signal passed between them. Guns in hand, the two men stepped across the threshold.